with we'll have a series of presenters, and we'll have an opportunity, as Gus said, after each presenter for technical questions. And hopefully at the end we'll have time for some discussion where we'll open up the call and you can raise questions in a number of ways. One is I've logged in using your email confirmation that you received when you registered, and a reminder today, you should be looking at your computer screen to see the slides, and you'll note that on the left-hand side, those questions there, and also you can very welcome to raise questions when Gus, you may do so by unmuting your line, and that is to press *7. So you may want to make a note right now that *7 unmute your line when we get to that point in the webinar. It'll be about an hour, and we've got quite a lot of to get through, very interesting up-to-date information. So hopefully that's all the technical things covered, but if you do need to ask a question, put it into the chat box, or you can email myself at beckawebconsulting@gmail.com, and I think Kevin can make that available to you so that you can email me with any questions about the tech.
Yes, or you can email me, gus@nam.org.uk.
Okay.
Have you got me? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. I'm now going to introduce Sarah Fidler, and I've just realized that I don't have your bio, Sarah, in front of me. But I do know you as a real sort of one of the most pioneering or indeed important HIV docs in London, and also very involved in the partner trial. So you better introduce yourself for a minute before you go into your first slide. But welcome. If you'd unmute Sarah, Dr. Fidler, take it away.
Thank you, Gus. Can you hear me okay?
I can, yes.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm very privileged to be part of this, and it's a great way to transfer information and answer questions. So I'm based at Imperial College in London. I do clinical work looking after people living with HIV at St Mary's Hospital, and I have particular clinical interest in looking after people who've only just become infected with HIV at seroconversion, and we've done a variety of trials looking at strategic use of therapy at early infection irrespective of CD4 count. And kind of as an extension of that, I've become involved in the whole concept of treatment as prevention. And just to clarify for the talk that I'm just going to go through in a moment, what I'm talking about here is treating using antiretroviral therapy for people living with HIV in addition to their own health benefits. And that's obviously the first and most important priority. But if you look at the impact it might well have on prevention of transmission of HIV to their sexual partners and children. And so as part of that, I'm the co-PI, so that's the sort of deputy, if you like, leader of a large HPTN trial called HPTN-071 Pop-Art, which is looking at the impact of treatment prevention in two countries in sub-Saharan Africa with very high HIV prevalence, that's South Africa and Zambia. So if that's sufficient introduction, I will move on to my slides. And I hope you can probably see the first slide. It's in black and white, quite plain. And here I'm talking about treatment of prevention, as I mentioned to you, really looking at the HIV-positive person. So what I thought I'd do briefly is just talk to you about why this is a focus of discussion and what the problems sort of are. And although we've seen really quite encouraging and very gratifying reductions at a global level of HIV incidence, so that's the number of new cases of HIV, the incidence still remains incredibly high and quite disappointingly high given that we've got such new and very effective prevention programs that should be available to most of people in particularly highly affected populations. And of course, we know that at some point most of the people living with HIV will need to go on to treatment. We've really got to look at the numbers of new infections we're getting, the numbers of people dying. Fantastic, thanks to antiretroviral therapy, that HIV is no longer a death sentence, but clearly the number of new infections of people living with HIV will increase the global burden of the virus. Looking at the tools we currently have and how we can better use them. Did I get the next slide, please? So this is to put treatment as prevention in the context, and this is a really important paper that looks at the other tools we have to prevent transmission. And after this, I'm not going to talk to you about them in any more detail, but just to make clear that, of course, giving antiretroviral therapy for the HIV-positive person who's in a relationship, in a discordant or zero-different couple, we call it, has really been shown beyond any doubt to be the most effective tool to prevent transmission in that context. And that's on the top of this chart, where anything to the left of that line shows how effective it is, and the nearer to the line, the more effective the intervention is. The top one is the HPTN-052 study, which showed a 96% effect of preventing transmission. And then the following studies defined on the left show PrEP studies. So this is giving antiretroviral elements to people who have not got HIV to prevent transmission. And whilst these have been very effective, they're not as effective. Prevention. Of course, there's medical male circumcision, which prevents the acquisition amongst HIV-negative men. And then we do know, of course, that a vaccine, which would be the perfect tool to prevent HIV at a global scale, is still woefully low in terms of its efficacy, and that's right at the bottom of this chart. The next slide, please. I do now just briefly summarise the evidence we've got whether treatment actually works, and then what are the unanswered questions. So the HPTN-052 study, which again I will talk to you about very briefly, but has shown us that it's incredibly effective. But this was mostly recruited in heterosexual couples where it was vaginal sex as a cause of transmission, and there's not so much data on different sexual exposures, particularly with anal intercourse. And the partner study is providing us with some really important evidence to look at this question, but it's not yet finished. And in terms of how this relates to a population level, we want to know if we've got treatment of prevention of the medication project. We don't actually have any evidence to know whether, if you really could roll this out at a population level, it within a community. So there's randomized trials that are going to look at this, and I'll just talk to you a little bit about them. Next slide, please. So why do we need more research on treatment of prevention? We know it can work, but as I mentioned, we don't know if it will work with different sexual behaviours. We don't know how to deliver it effectively. And at what level of coverage do we need the different elements of treatment of prevention? Because, of course, one of the key elements for treatment of prevention to work is to get people to test for HIV. And then we've got to link them into care, and we've got to put interventions across each step of the cascade, which I'm sure you're all very aware of, but at the moment are woefully limited in actually being able to deliver people to be safely on treatments. And then what I think is really important to look at is the potential adverse effects. This is the programmatic delivery, and it may well be that the adverse effects are still totally outweighed by the benefits, but I think it's really important for us to look at this.
Sarah?
Yeah?
You're dropping out a little bit. I don't know why. I'm your sort of... I don't know if this is your phone or
it's
AVEC.
My phone.
Are you on speakerphone?
Is it better if I'm like that?
Oh, much better, yes.
Okay, sorry about that. Yep, I'll do it.
Okay, carry on.
I was looking at the adverse effects of doing treatment of prevention if it was programmatically rolled out across communities, and saying that we really feel that we need to have a look at the impact or the negative impact, if there are any, and this would include drug resistance, drug toxicities, whether there was some sort of sexual risk disinhibition at a population level, which may well reduce the efficacy of the intervention. Of course, stigma, and stigma for those people who choose perhaps not to test, and those people who do test but for whatever reason choose not to go on to treatment. And, of course, importance of coercion, of people feeling that they must test and must go on treatment if that doesn't feel right for them. And then impact at healthcare service levels to make sure that they're not overloaded towards our HIV programs and therefore against other programs. Next slide, please. So just briefly, the partner study, I think, is a really important observational multi-center study across sites in 75 different places in Europe. And the aim is to evaluate the risk of within-couple transmissions, both heterosexual and men who have sex with men, on transmission of HIV to the negative partner. And the eligibility is that there has got to be a positive partner who is suppressed on antiretroviral therapy at entry into the study. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Can you get the next slide? Thank you. So this is looking at the types of sex that are within those couples, and I hope you realise that this study is really important to address the different sexual practices that were perhaps not in so much detail looked at in the 052 study. And you can see that they're broken down in the different colours of vaginal sex with ejaculate, just vaginal sex alone in the red, receptive anal intercourse with ejaculate in the pale green, and just insertive anal sex. And these are really important to be able to address the question that many of our patients and couples really want to know the answer to, which is what is the real risk of transmission for these different practices if the positive partner is on treatment. Next slide, please. And the rates of transmission in an interim analysis that was presented by one of the PIs, Alison Roger, at CROI this year, showed that to date there have been zero transmissions within couples. Next slide, please. Next slide. Oh, sorry. So in conclusion, so far this was interim analysis. They haven't achieved enough couple-year follow-up to report on the overall study that was powered, and that's why additional follow-up is ongoing up till 2017. But as far as we know, this is incredibly encouraging to suggest that for the various different sex acts I've just mentioned, if the positive partner's viral load is below 200 copies per mil, there seems to be zero risk of transmission. Next slide, please. And then I'm sure everybody knows, and Ruben I know is on the call, but we're going to talk about the test and treat concept. So if we think from 052 and from the preliminary data from partner, treatment does prevent transmission to sexual partners. How would it play out if we could roll this out at a community level? And this is the original Greenwich paper in The Lancet that showed us that if we did universal testing and treatment in the green line, followed by immediate antiretroviral therapy for everybody irrespective of CD4 count, we should see a dramatic reduction in incidence. Next slide, please. And the study that we are running, as I mentioned, the HPTN-071 pop-up trial, is looking at actually effectiveness of this study concept. So it's a universal testing linking to care with the offer of immediate treatment, and then the outcome is going to be HIV population level incidence. Next slide, please. And the study is a community randomized trial into three arms, where the arm A communities get the universal test and treat approach. In addition, I'd just like to point out two other combination prevention prospects that are offered at the community level, so male circumcision, PMTCT for positive women, promotion of sexual health, condom provision, and TB and linkage to care. In arm B communities, they get all the same, most importantly, the home-based voluntary testing at the community level in the households, but ART is initiated only according to national guidelines, and importantly here, the national guidelines have and will continue to change, and as they do so in this arm, guidelines will be adhered to strictly. And in arm C communities, these are communities that have care according to what is current standard of care. And the outcome measure is primary incidence at 36 months. So that gives us 3 years to really try and roll out this broad-based intervention at a community level. Next slide, please. And as with all these really important questions research-wise, there are several other trials similarly designed to address the same question, because we want to have at least three randomized trial evidence in order to change guidelines. So this is the SEARCH study, which is run by Diane Havlier and colleagues, based in Kenya. Again, a community randomized intervention where they are doing regular testing, offering immediate antiretroviral therapy, as well as looking at TB, malaria, maternal and child health. And this is, again, ongoing and should report in the next year or two. Next slide, please. In parallel, there's a Botswana combination prevention trial, which, again, is a community-based intervention of households with universal testing and linkage to care and immediate antiretroviral therapy for those with a high threshold viral load who have CD4 counts above current levels of guidelines for initiation.
Hi, Sarah, your 12 minutes is up. I know it's
okay,
I've
got my last slide, if that's all right. Sorry. And then the final trial is the TASP trial, which is being run by the Africa Center in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. And again, this is a two-arm community randomized trial
which is looking at a universal test and treat arm compared to the guidelines arm. But as the guidelines are moving, I think this trial may have to amend its design to make sure it's still got power. Final slide. So in summary, I think I hope I've showed you that there's really high level of individual evidence that treatment is very effective at preventing transmission amongst heterosexual serodifferent couples and probably similarly amongst couples who engage in anal intercourse as well from the interim analysis from the partner study. What I think we still don't really know is the effectiveness at reducing HIV incidence in a generalized epidemic, and that's what these four trials that I've very briefly shown you their design are designed to address. And thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Sarah. Sorry it was a bit glitchy halfway through if you didn't quite catch everything Sarah was saying. Just a reminder, yeah, it's helpful if you don't use speakerphones. Anyway, are there any sort of burning technical questions that any of you have right now? If you really, if there was something you didn't understand and felt it was crucial, if you want to ask a question, I'll allow a couple of minutes, just press *7 and unmute yourself. And if not, we will assume that everybody is completely stunned by what you've been saying, Sarah.
Thank you, Gus.
I would highlight a couple of things for later discussion. One is the sort of, you whizzed past what I think is the sort of meat of the partner study, which is the slide with relative risks on. And that may need a little explanation because I know people have been confused about how zero transmissions can turn into sort of what's a statistical risk of transmissions, as it were. And the other thing is just to emphasize how enormous these treatment as prevention community studies are. I mean, I think PopArt has something like 1.2 million people in it. Extraordinary scientific undertaking where people are being sort of, where whole communities are being randomized to different strategies against HIV. Huge enterprises. Anyway, any questions people have got? Nope. Okay. All right. Well, in that case, I will hand over to Ruben Granik, who has already been mentioned in by Sarah.
That's Kevin. We did have one question about when are the results from the partner study expected? So we'll have
Okay. Good. When are the results expected, Sarah?
2017, I think, is the final analysis.
Final analysis. We had some interim ones last year. Are we going to get any more interim stuff?
I'm not exactly sure, Gus. I think you're probably more involved in the details than I am. But
I'm not.
trying to get what they call the couple's year follow-up. So they've done all the very clever mathematics that Andrew Phillips has led with to look at how many years of follow-up is it required for the anticipated reach the primary endpoint and really to get an answer on the numbers. And so that's where they got to with the 2017.
So we will hear when there is a sort of another, there is more significance to the findings. Okay. That's fantastic. I will introduce Ruben Granik now, who was mentioned by Sarah, who has over 20 years' experience in health and development, working with a variety of organisations but currently at UNAIDS. And I know that Ruben is one of the sort of the primary researchers in the world when it comes to sort of actually modelling work and looking at the impact, the possible impact, not only of treatment as prevention, but of all kinds of sort of global strategies about how to deal with HIV and related illnesses. I think that's all I need to say about Ruben. He's got some very interesting slides. Keep it to 12 minutes. and take it away.
All right. Thank you, Gus and Nam and everybody on the line. I really appreciate this opportunity to speak with you all. And you're going to hear the difference between the proper English accent and the barbarian colony accent from California. I'll do my best to go slowly. Next slide, please. So I wanted to start a little bit big picture here, and with any new technology, there is, this is basically what the curve or the diagram, the concept looks like. And, you know, like with iPhones or with treatment or with PrEP, there's usually early enthusiasts, visionaries, and then we run the risk of actually falling into the chasm. And then there's pragmatists, conservatives, and skeptics. And I think that we all find ourselves in different places on this curve. I think to end AIDS, we've been very, very fast, but we need to go much more quickly. And I'm going to try and make the argument that we need to go more quickly with access to treatment as part of our global response. Next slide. I think I'm talking about treatment as prevention slightly differently than the other two speakers. And by the way, Sarah's talk was great. I actually see it along a number of different axes. I think treatment, or we know that treatment prevents illness. We know that it prevents death, and we know that it prevents transmission. There are some questions about who it prevents transmission in, but I think that those are being worked out. And we also are increasingly finding that it prevents costs. So, and I wanted to get that out there, and I also wanted to say that, you know, the transmission benefit actually for us, you know, people that have been working on this, is actually secondary. We're really most concerned about preventing people from becoming ill and from dying, and we want to help them live a healthy lifestyle. And this talk has actually helped me think maybe there's another axis there that's actually preventing stigma, because I think stigma is a huge problem for us. Next slide. So these slides I'm going to make available in PowerPoint, and I have a much longer slide set, and these are just meant to be kind of memes or ideas. Look, the studies are showing that earlier treatment is better in terms of illness and in terms of death. So this is 052 and a sub-analysis, and it looks that if you start earlier, actually you have less of these terrible illnesses and problems. And there are many other studies that are like this, and if you look at the abstracts from CROI or other conferences, you can see that this is where we're heading with. Earlier is better, especially when there's viral replication. Next slide. And the next slide shows us that viral replication actually is independent of CD4 count. Now, for people living in the north, you have access to viral replication, but people living in the south, I'm going to just label them that way, most people don't have access to viral load. So they don't really know what's going on in terms of their viral load, and they're at risk of serious morbidity and mortality from replicating virus. So that's what these two studies show. Next slide. Now, Brian and Williams, who's the primary modeler that I work with on these sort of things, we started to think about what is the risk of AIDS, serious non-AIDS, or death using the Angleray paper, which is based out of West Africa, if you wait. And so, you know, if the bottom line is that if you wait, we think, and we're working on this isn't final, and we need to look at the risks and the benefits, but we think that waiting to less than 200, you might run the risk of around 40% of these serious events. Waiting to less than 350 could be 21%, less than 500, 15%, and less than 950, 2%. The point being isn't whether those percentages are right, but the point being is the framing. Should people be asked to wait, or should they be offered treatment early? And you know, obviously, we're arguing earlier is better. Next slide, please. Now, this is 052, showing that transmission, you know, people on treatment really don't transmit. It's very, very low. It might be, and now I know that it makes a difference, but it's way above 90%. We knew this actually earlier. I mean, TM meta-analysis showed this, Quinn's work showed this, et cetera, but this RCT really put the nail in the coffin, and people should know about this and have options to take treatment if they want to prevent transmission. Next slide, please. And here we look at some evidence that's coming from communities. Now, of course, these communities did a lot of things besides treatment, but they also implemented early access to treatment. You see Vancouver, you see Taiwan, you see San Francisco, and they're seeing declining incidence in their cities. And they're also seeing high viral load suppression and these sorts of things. So the ecological evidence suggests that the more treatment out there, the better it is for in terms of transmission. And I'm not showing what happens in terms of illness and death, but Vancouver's just closed their AIDS ward. Next slide. People say that this is an ecological study. This is not an ecological study. This is an observational study. This is from KZN in South Africa. And what these folks showed, and it's an amazing piece of work, it shows that basically what happens in the community matters to you if you're HIV negative. Your risk, your individual risk, goes up if the coverage is low of ART. Makes sense, right? But these people actually showed this with a very nice study, and it shows that as the coverage goes up by 1%, roughly, your incidence chance or chance of being infected goes down by 1%. So this is really remarkable stuff coming from Sub-Saharan Africa. Next slide, please. I want to switch gears slightly and go to go to what's going on with WHO and the guidelines. Here you see the timeline across the center there. You see when WHO has made the change, less than 350, less than 500. The countries below are actually at WHO level or behind, and the countries above are ahead of WHO. And what this slide shows is that about 10 countries out there now have gone to immediate treatment. Next slide. And this is what it looks like globally. So the countries in blue are actually ones that are have gone to immediate treatment, and I'm not going to list them all. The countries in orange have gone to consider less than 500, and the countries in green are the less than 500, which is WHO, and the rest are what we could call behind or waiting to adapt the guidelines. Now, we say that you should be following WHO guidelines. What this slide illustrates is that it's very dynamic and that we think that countries are actually moving to earlier and earlier treatment. Next slide, please. Now, they asked me to talk a little bit about modeling. This slide was already shown. I think why this is significant is that we raised the issue, and others had already raised it before us, but basically that testing and ART impacts incidence and survival. So that's really important. You can see that we use less than 350 as well. We also put out there that maybe elimination is feasible. This isn't elimination of people living with HIV. This is actually elimination of the virus. And this is something that changed from a chronic to we can have a solution to this epidemic, and we should be thinking about solutions. And then treatment is part of that solution. Next slide, please. Now, when we also crudely modeled the costing in this thing, and what this slide shows is this is from the Lancet paper as well, this shows that it was within the envelope of our current spending, right? So that actually raises that question. What are we spending, and do we have enough? And then it also said that if you front load, you may end up with cost savings. Now, very crude. Next slide. We did this with more sophistication in the PLOS One article, and this showed basically these two slides show that depending on how much coverage you get, you can save millions of lives and actually end up saving billions of dollars. And I'm not saying that because of this model that South Africa's changed, but South Africa's definitely heading in the direction of offering more and more treatment and earlier treatment for its people. Next slide. Here's PEPFAR. PEPFAR also did modeling and is using modeling extensively to look at their investments. And you can see the cost of treatment going down in the world. And actually, we're looking at something like $100 a year for people on treatment, and in other places, even lower. So that it's really quite remarkable, this decrease in treatment costs. Next slide. And Gus had asked that we focus a little bit on, or I thought we should focus a little bit on concentrated epidemics. We've taken this model and looked at what in Vietnam, and what this is to illustrate is that there may be ways to ensure that people aren't left behind and that key populations labeled here, if we focus on them, we might have a major impact on the epidemic. And that's actually far more pertinent to people living in Europe and places where the epidemic is happening in these communities, and we need to actually reach out to them and ensure they have access to testing and treatment. Next slide. And when we do the modeling and you look here, it's basically offering annual treatment and offering early access to treatment and on annual testing and early access treatment, along with other interventions, opioid substitution therapy, condoms, and these sorts of things, makes the most impact for these key populations. And that's really, really important because that's going to help the government reorient itself to offering services to these people. And we hope that that's in the best interest of the people that they're offering the services to. Next slide. And this is a country in sub-Saharan Africa, I'm not going to label it, who's basically looking at what would happen if we increased access to ART and or offered it earlier and then also just offered it immediately for key populations. And the impact is huge and the cost is not that much, about $12 million, which is small for them. And that's the direction that they went after doing the analysis. Next slide. So are we on track to scale? Well, 52% of people living with HIV don't know their status right now globally, right? 22 million aren't on treatment. We have about 1.5 million deaths. We have 2.1 million new infections. So we've done well, but we have a lot of work to do, I would argue, and we all need to be on board with that. We know that everyone living with HIV will need ART to survive, and they need to have access to that. They need to have the option to not go on it if they would like, but that right now most people don't have that option. And then I would argue that instead of narrowly focusing on whether the ART impacts transmission, which is a really important question and interesting, it's actually along that axis that I described. It's about preventing illness. It's about preventing death. It's about preventing transmission. And it's about preventing costs. And I would hope that, I don't know, I would hope that actually having access to treatment would also be about preventing stigma as well, because as people more people get on treatment, and as this transforms, we would hope, into something that's a little bit more normalized in places that where many people have HIV and it becomes more like diabetes than or other chronic illnesses, that the stigma would be less, and as fears about transmission go down. And we saw some of that hysteria around the Ebola outbreak. Next slide, please. So at UNAIDS, we had the 15 million by 2015, and we're going to reach that that target. We're fairly certain about that. And now we're thinking beyond that. And we came up with the 90-90-90 targets. Now, a lot of people have criticized this, but many others, like PEPFAR and others, have actually endorsed this. Please accept these as our effort to make sure that no one is left behind. So this isn't 50-50-50. This isn't 60-60-60. This is 90-90-90. And actually, there are many of us that argue this should be 100-100-100, because no one should actually not have a chance to be on treatment. So this is what we're putting out, and this is our chapeau, our framework that we're driving towards. And you notice the virally suppressed target there. It's not just about putting people on treatment. It's actually about ensuring that they can stay on treatment, that they have access to second line, and that they can be durably suppressed. And I know it's horribly technical, but that they can live happily and healthily without fear of their medicines not being there, and without fear of not having this life-saving treatment. Next slide. So I wanted to thank everybody. I know that was a kind of a blitzkrieg, very, very fast. Again, you'll have the slides, and I hope that they'll make available the longer slide set. And I should have mentioned in the beginning, these are my personal views, of course, and United Nations has not, UNAIDS has not screened them or these sorts of things. And that allows me to speak a little bit more freely. So I really thank you for your attention.
Thanks very much, Reuben. There's a lot there. And as Reuben has said, he's very generously given us a much longer slide set, which I think we'll be putting up on the EADG and AVEX sites. So has anybody got any, there's no way you can avoid the treatment of prevention being technical with all these models and things, but has anybody got any urgent questions in terms of things that they really didn't understand or feel were very crucial to help them understand what Reuben has just been presenting? I have a very simple one myself, Reuben. I've never understood these terms. What's the difference between an ecological study and an observational study?
Well, I'll give it a shot here. Sarah is a researcher, so she knows these things much better than I do. My definition of an ecological study is basically, ecological studies, you look at what's happened, let's say a health outcome like decrease in incidence, and then you look at what kind of conditions were there in the community, and you say, well, it's because there was a lot of treatment, or it was because there was a lot of needle exchange, or because of XYZ, and you draw the conclusion that there's an association between what the intervention was and the outcome. When in reality, in an ecological study, there are a lot of confounders that you can't really control for in migration and these sorts of things. So the evidence by pure researchers is disparaged on some level. It's downgraded because it's not a true study. The observational study. The observational study, the one that I spoke of at KZN, is that they have a database with every person in that community, almost every person in that community's information, right? Age, sex, all of these sorts of things. And it's actually, as part of their study, where they're looking at many other different outcomes, they look at HIV infection, and then they're able to do analyses and look at risk. And that's far different than what was done in these other cities. And that's kind of a crude definition.
Okay. All right. Thanks. That's really helpful. Okay, I'm going to introduce Sylvia, because inevitably of questions and the introduction, which I always forget to put in, we're a bit behind, but that's all right. We should still have 15 minutes or so for questions afterwards. Sylvia I've known for years. I hope she doesn't mind me saying that. She's a fabulous HIV activist. She can tell they're based in London now, although hails from, I think, Naples, isn't it? Coordinator of POSFEM UK, the British National Network of Women Living with HIV. She's at Positively UK, which is an NGO of and supporting positive people in the UK. And she's now the chair of the UK Community Advisory Board. I think Sylvia will be representing, well, you know, kind of the patient point of view, apart from anything else. Mm-hmm. So, Sylvia, if you're unmute yourself with star 7, and let's hear from you.
Hello. Hello. Hi, Gus. Can you hear me? Am I live? Okay, thanks a lot much for this opportunity and to offer a different perspective in this debate. I hope people can cope with my Italian accent. And, yes, can you please offer the next slide? Next slide, please. So, well, this is my full disclosure. I've been HIV positive since 1997. I started treatment in 1998. You can see there a list of all the drugs I've taken, almost most class of drugs has been through my body. And luckily, my viral load is undetectable and my CD4 count is over 500. I would be dead without ARVs, so I am a very committed treatment advocate. Next slide, please. So I want us to look at the journey that we all go on once we become HIV positive, and it is very important that we look at the different speeds that we need to take during our journey, and keep our eyes on the dashboard. Can you please the next slide? So the dashboard, during this journey, we need to go from a speed of 0 to 1 of 100. And it is very important that we address each and every step at the right speed. Otherwise, we will burn the engine. So if you, next slide, please. So from 0 to 60, which is a very safe journey, it is addressing really the issues around the quality of care and the services we access, but also issues of security, food security, and other illnesses and, you know, general quality of services. Can I have the next slide, please? So behind these are some basic ethical principles of care that already have been mentioned, but the doctor's duties are primarily to the individual, and the doctor-patient relationship and the trust in it is crucial. The duty of the doctor is to prevent death and relieve suffering, and first of all, do not harm. Next slide. So this is just a list of what care should include, and obviously, I want to stress that care does not just mean treatment. It means discussion. It means time to ask questions and answers. It needs a combination of many, many things. Next slide, please. So at the core of good care, there is informed choice. And what does it mean? It means for the individual, the patient, to be given non-judgmental information, and for the individual to make that choice. And the choice should be whether or not to take medication and which medication to take. And also the time and the support to think through options. Next slide. So I will not go through this, but this is a questionnaire that was developed to access complementary therapies. But I think that this is a very, very simple question that anybody dealing with HIV, accessing HIV medication, could use as well. Next slide, please. So, well, now we are going to move to full speed and look at access to ARVs once, you know, we put all the other steps in place. So we are speeding up from 60 kilometers an hour to 80. Next slide, please. So basic pharmacological principles, I have around those. So chemicals should do more benefit than harm, and obviously the harm of dying of AIDS has been a great fear of mine. I understand drugs are there to do that. And by principle of pharmacology is that the minimum dose should be used for the minimum time in order to ensure the maximum benefits are harnessed. Next slide, please. And I would like to go just a step back on how drugs are approved by the Food and Drug Administration Board in the USA. And first of all, this board, we should not forget, is now at the moment funded 8% by pharmaceutical companies. And for drugs to be deemed safe for use, they just need to be comparable as a safe as a placebo and more effective. And this is not really spelled out as much more effective than it to be. It's quite vague. Next slide. Another an example of a wonder drug that went to the FDA approval is Viagra, and that was, you know, fantastic. Erectile dysfunction is a big issue for men. And approved in 1998, in 2005, Pfizer was ordered to put on its label that it can cause irreversible vision damage and, in rare cases, blindness. But that's to show how long it can take for side effects on a medication to emerge, for safety to be really be understood. Next slide. This also is happening in, you know, Viagra is only one of many drugs which side effects were only known after a long time. I would like everybody to be available, every treatment advocate to be available, that at the moment pharmaceutical companies are not legally bound to publish any negative information which they may know about their products. Not all trials are registered and published. And that's why we at the UK CAB and many other organizations are supporting a campaign called All Trials Campaign, so that we can have all trials results published. And you can Google it and sign it online if you're interested. Next slide, please. Sorry, my computer has gone blind. So we are now going 100 kilometers an hour and addressing the use of treatment as prevention. Next slide, please. And we already gone through this, but there are very, very different guidelines around the world now about when to start treatment. I feel very safe in the UK because I know that our guidelines for starting when our CD4 count is under 350 is based on a very sound evidence of a randomized clinical trial. And what we are waiting for, in a way, to revise the evidence is the results of the START trial, which we will not have until 2016. The START trial is really looking at the individual benefit of somebody living with HIV of starting earlier. And it is, you know, it's the gold standard of research as an RCT. And even when that trial is really released, I want to stress, it's still going to be our own choice when and how to start treatment. Next slide. So some basic ethical principles that need to be considered behind treatment as prevention. If one person must take medication to benefit someone else, this is an unbalanced equation. And I'm not really sure that we should offloading risks. So I'm taking the risks of all the toxicities to prevent somebody else to acquire HIV. I think the shared responsibility is something that should be promoted. And also, while this kind of risk obviously is acceptable when you are pregnant because the baby inside my womb, inside a woman's womb, doesn't have any other choice. But is it fair that this risk should be aimed at women living with HIV? And I'm now talking about option B plus, that if you don't know, option B plus is a treatment option that's been widely rolled out in Africa, which tests all women living with HIV for HIV and puts them immediately, regardless of CD4 count, on lifelong treatment. And one of the benefits of option B plus is that it would reduce also horizontal transmission to their partners, to their male partners. And one of the ethical question is it right to select women living with HIV to have this option to protect men, while men are not asked to take treatment to protect women? So there is an imbalance there. Next slide. So, and also, should be pregnant women be prioritized for treatment for a reason other than the immediate personal need? And what will be the implication? What are the implications within the household and within the community? Because they get treatment access, and other people that might need it even more than them are not getting the treatment. And, you know, what is going to be the consequence of this. And this is selective test and treat intervention. Are they ethical in the sense that we need to treat first the people that are dying, that who are really, really sick and need treatment immediately? And you see, as you can see, all those ethical issues come from an article from The Lancet. Next slide, please. So once again, is it ethical to give women with a high CD4 count treatment for lifelong without understanding their long-term benefits and risks? We don't know, you know, nobody's been on treatment for very long. This treatment hasn't been around for long. And also, how will this compromise the supply to other groups who might need it for their own health in resource-limited settings when drug supply is restricted? Next slide, please.
Hi, Sylvia, it's Gus. I'm going to have to hurry you up a little bit so that we have time.
All right, okay. I mean, so there are a series of medical issues. Next, I will not go through them.
Maybe you skip the rest of the article. I think you've got some really important stuff at the end about gender and violence.
Yes, I would like to go to the elephant in the room.
You skip to the elephant in the room, Kevin.
Well, okay, here we have an elephant in the room. I mean, there is a number of ethical and other questions around treating women, pregnant women, but the elephant in the room is that what is driving the epidemics for women is very much an epidemic of gender-based violence as well. The fact that women do not have a mean to protect themselves, you know, when negotiating safer sex, and also healthcare settings can be violent toward women. So next slide. So intimate partner violence is also a consequence of HIV diagnosis and ARV uptakes, and this comes from the Malawian Network of Women Living with HIV. And the first causalities are when women suffer violence within the house because they found out that they're positive because they have taken pills back home, is that the mental health goes down, and ARV's adherence goes down. And women have a lot of fears towards disclosure in option B+. And women as well experience guilt because they have medication while their children and partners and others in their family don't. So please, next slide. Basically, for me, the case is that we cannot address HIV and HIV prevention and HIV treatment for women unless we address the interconnected epidemics of violence and HIV. And my last slide are some quick conclusions, some example of good practice the example of good practice were practices in which the meaningful involvement of women living with HIV went throughout the program, and that in order for treatment and prevention and care to really work for women, we need the funding and capacity building for women with HIV and their networks to address structural power imbalances, address gender-based violence, and increase the quality of care, including treatment and prevention. Phew. Thank you. That's it. Yeah.
That's wonderful. I mean, we can't cover... Can you hear me, by the way?
Yes, I can.
Yep. Okay. We can't cover all the issues in an hour. I know. This is a fantastically complex... treatment and prevention is very complex because it does involve all these... socioeconomic and questions as well as medical ones, and thank you for bringing those up. We've got not as long as I would have liked for questions, about 10 minutes, but have people got burning ones that they're dying to ask right now? I have a few stocked up here that I can ask on behalf of the people who've sent them through. No? Okay.
I have one. I mean...
Yes. Who's speaking?
This is Ruben.
Hi, Ruben.
Just one observation about the Lancet article, the anti-B-plus article. I mean,
yeah.
I think that what we've seen happen in Malawi is that the access for women and probably for children on some level to treatment has gone up by over 100% in Malawi with the with option B plus. I mean, there's been an enormous jump in the number of HIV positive women who have been able to actually access treatment behind B plus. And that doesn't mean that other people don't get treatment. It just means that they get access. So I would take issue a little bit with the characterization of B plus as something that's only used in Africa as well, because this is what we use in the United States and many other countries. Basically, if people are HIV positive and they're pregnant, they should be on treatment to save their lives and prevent transmission to their children and to their partners. So I just
Yes, but B plus is lifelong treatment. It's not just treatment during pregnancy. So it's a big different issue.
Yeah. No, we get it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are
and there is evidence of women dropping out as well very early because
Yeah, I was going to say that. I mean,
violence.
I think I was going to say that on the one hand, I think that it's very important to find ways of extending treatment to as many people as possible. On the other hand, yes, if that results in big dropout rates, then that's not necessarily a good thing. One thing, the Beba guidelines, as Sylvia says, are still at 350, which is looking a bit old-fashioned these days. But on the other hand, they do emphasize that if a patient wants to take drugs for prevention reasons, then they should be allowed to do so. And in fact, more than 50% of people who have CD4 counts above 350 now starts treatment on diagnosis in the UK. So a guideline doesn't necessarily mean that everyone's sticking to that guideline.
No.
As long as physicians are conscious of laying out to patients in a kind of neutral way the advantages of being on treatment. I've got a question here. This is slightly more technical for perhaps Sarah or Ruben. A lot of treatment as prevention strategies rely on viral load monitoring. But how closer are we to getting a cheap viral load test that you could use in low-income settings?
Sarah, do you want me to answer that or try to?
I think you might be the person to do it.
Bit, yeah.
So there's quite a good UNAIDS, I'm sure Ruben will tell you all about it, but there's a good UNAIDS initiative about developing what's called point-of-care viral load testing, which is really going to have to be the way forward. And at the moment, when I imagine a point of care, I kind of think of it like a little paper strip, like we do a point of care HIV test. But it's not like that at the moment. It's a machine that goes on a sort of bench somewhere. It's quite expensive, but I think that there is a really important initiative to push this forward. And in the greater scheme of the world, I think what we would imagine is that people will use that in preference to CD4 monitoring.
So, and what I would add is that's the major difference between North and South. The access to the viral loads is just not there in the South. We're moving away from using CD4 counts for staging, which are just too, for monitoring. It's just too crude. UNAIDS has worked with others, PEPFAR, Global Fund, et cetera, to leverage a far lower price for the viral loads from one of the companies. I'm not going to say it. I don't want to give them the publicity, but they've come to a lower price. We think that actually with this initiative that we will actually be able to drive prices further down and that viral load will become de rigueur for managing people in developing countries. And that's going to be coming to us soon. And we have to just go much harder and faster and make sure that that's a reality for everyone. Because it's really not fair to ask somebody it's not fair to ask them to say, well, look, here's your CD4 count. We can't tell you how fast it's going to decline or whether you have viral replication. Please wait a year and come back in and get another CD4 count. It's just not fair.
Ruben, can I just add to that, stating the obvious here, but it's one thing for the companies to make a viral load test a certain price, but of course the reality, which is what we've seen with CD4 testing, is it means that the lab's got to get the blood, it's got to be spun down, it's got to be...
True.
There are so many steps, if you like, another separate cascade in terms of monitoring. So I still think that whilst it's fantastic news, of course, that the actual test itself costs less, it requires a functioning lab, and I think that is another really important stumbling block, as well as all the pathways in the middle of people actually taking time off work or to get to the clinic to have their blood taken.
Well, and that goes back to Gus's original statement of the problem, and that is to say that test and treat relies on viral load. It actually doesn't. And when we propose it in the model and in other places, for example, the option B plus, it's not, and many of the other parts of the WHO test and treat, it doesn't require viral load. That's just something that's been introduced, as well as CD4. These are things that we're trying to actually remove that barrier on some level.
Okay. So listen, I've got room for about one more question, and I think we should ask a more general one. So in a way, this is unfair because this is a biggie, but it's one of the biggies in treatment as prevention. And it says, ART coverage reduces incidence in some places, but why doesn't it seem to have the same effect in others, including London? That's a big one.
I can take a stab at that. I think it depends on, and at the risk of being impolitic here, it depends on how you use your treatment as prevention. My understanding of the studies there show that maybe a third of people or 20% of people don't know their HIV status, and the other, maybe there's 20 or 25% that are not on, that know their HIV status but that aren't on treatment. So you have about half of the people there that are on treatment. So you're really using only half of the power of treatment as prevention. And so, of course, and it requires other things as well. You know, I mean, it's not just treatment that's going to make the difference. So when you combine that with other interventions that need to be scaled up, then you wind up with a diminished effect of treatment as prevention. But I would argue that you're actually having an effect there with the people that you have on treatment already. So
okay.
A little bit of a complicated answer, but you're getting treatment as prevention benefit. It's just that you're not getting maximal benefit because not everybody knows their status and not everyone is on treatment.
And the sort of follow-up to that is, of course, some people still don't think that they need to be on treatment because they don't feel ill, and I think this particularly applies to some populations like young people. How do we, you know, because I think this is what Sylvia was talking about, you know, how do we help people with the decisions about coming on treatment? Do you have anything to say about that, Sylvia?
Well, I think that people need to understand why they are on treatment, and it is possible through community-based treatment advocacy to develop that treatment literacy and motivation for people to be on treatment. What worries me is that while we spend billions on the treatment, I don't see any ring-fence money to develop the treatment literacy and the treatment capacity to deal with it.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. Community education, of which this is an example, is key. Listen, I'm going to have to finish. And I need to say a little bit, thank you very much. There will be room to ask other questions on email, which we could get answered. This is also very much part of an introductory program to the meeting in January. Now, I need to, so as to avoid disappointment, I need to say this is already oversubscribed, but if you don't apply to come to the meeting, you won't get there. It promises to be a very interesting meeting with a lot of really interesting key experts coming to talk. Certainly Ruben is coming to talk to that one. I think we've got Alice and Roger instead of Sarah to talk about that area of things. So please do indicate your interest for the 23rd, 24th, 25th January meeting. Thank you very much. Rebecca, are we doing any feedback mechanism for this webinar? Are you there?
Sorry, I was on mute. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
As you log off, there should be a questionnaire coming up for you to enter comments. We really welcome your feedback on this webinar so that we can ensure a high standard as we go forward. I think it's been excellent personally today with excellent speakers and contributions. And obviously the conversation has to continue from this point. So do keep those ideas coming and keep in touch.
And the next one is in 2 weeks' time, slightly different time. I think it's 1500, 3 p.m. GMT, 4 p.m. European time. And this will be on PrEP with, of course, as you may be aware, some very interesting European results just announced. Inevitably, because it's these studies of involved gay men will probably have more of a focus on that community, but we will no doubt be talking about its possible use as a strategy in other groups too. And I know Rebecca has already put out an invitation to register for that one. So thanks very much, those of you who joined. If you had questions that you couldn't ask or I didn't ask for you, I'm sorry, but do come to the January meeting if you can. Anything else, Rebecca, and presenters? Any last words?
Just thank you very much for the opportunity, and it's great to be in dialogue with everybody. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, Gus.
Thanks, everybody.
All right. Thank you, and goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.